This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Kalamazoo State Representative John Hoadley discusses the state budget, gun laws, and other issues before the legislature. But first, every week, NPR's TED Radio Hour explores topics through the ideas which are presented at TED Talks across the country. Recent broadcasts have included discussions on how the brain works, love, the seven deadly sins, secrecy, and fear. The program airs on public radio stations across the country, including at 11 o'clock Saturday mornings on WMUK. Guy Raz is the host and editorial director of the TED Radio Hour, and he joins us from Washington, D.C. Guy Raz, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Gordon.
Can you take us through the process a little bit of how you find TED Talks and then kind of meld them together and come up with a theme for a one-hour program?
Yeah. There's no real rhyme or reason, you know, because I think, as you know, like what we do, right, as journalists is a sort of a weird profession because it's not a science, right? There's no formula or equation. It's more of an art, and you kind of just rely on your judgment. And so really the way it works is sometimes there'll be a TED Talk that I will have seen or that I will really like, and I'll sort of put it aside. I've got a list of talks that I love. And I will watch them and take down very, very detailed notes about the things that that stood out and that jump out at me. And I'll take these keywords and I'll look for a possible thematic kind of show to build around those words, one of those words. So, for example, there's a talk that I love by Ken Robinson, whose talk is all about creativity. So I knew that I wanted to do a show about the source of creativity. And then it began, this is sort of then the process begins as kind of like building a puzzle. You know, you find other talks that might work with it and you consider which ones will go with it. And that's sort of one way we do it. And the other way we do it is there is a theme that we want to hit on. You know, there's something that we really want to do that we think is going to be cool, like a show we did recently on the seven deadly sins. And so we'll begin with a thematic idea and then kind of build the show around it by searching out for talks that could work in that theme and interviews that, you know, that will work in that theme.
Have you found some really good TED Talks that you found very interesting and yet you haven't found a way to get them into the TED Radio Hour yet?
Yes, yes. Actually, the best example is a guy named Hans Rosling, who's like a rock star of the TED world. He's given, I think, 4 or 5 TED Talks. They're amazing talks. And he is an economist from Sweden. And he has these talks that are incredibly funny and visual. But our challenge has been to figure out how to make those work on the radio. He's got a very dry sense of humor. So you kind of have to see his winks and his sort of raised eyebrows. And he uses a lot of imagery and a lot of props to explain these big concepts about human populations and birth rates and things like that. And so we've sort of been struggling to figure out how to make it happen. I think maybe this season we will figure it out. I'm crossing my fingers because I love his talks. He's amazing. But so far, it's been tough.
Are there some subjects that you are kind of in progress on where you say, boy, we'd really like to do an episode on this, and maybe you have 2 TED Talks, but you need a couple more, or maybe you're even just one short, and if you could find that last TED Talk that fits into that theme, then you'd have one more TED Radio Hour?
Yes, and in fact, maybe we can try a crowdsourcing experiment right here, Gordon, which is I will tell you a couple of episodes that we would love to do, and maybe some of your listeners can send us ideas if they've run into a TED Talk. So one idea I have is a show called The Road Less Taken, and I've got 2 talks that would work perfectly for that show, but we're having trouble finding other talks that would work with that show, that theme. Another one that I would love to do that, you know, we're still kind of finding the right talks, believe it or not, is just wisdom. And it's not because there aren't lots of talks that deal with this idea of wisdom or seeking or searching wisdom or wise people. We've used a lot of those talks in other episodes and, you know, on topics that are not necessarily related directly to wisdom. But I would love to do a show about wisdom, you know, about sort of you know, any kind of way to get into that theme. So those are two topics that we've got them on. I've got a whiteboard in my office. It's like a crazy man scrawling, you know, with arrows pointing in different directions and names in different places. And so, you know, when I build that, you know, it's a growing and living, breathing thing. So sometimes, you know, I'll wipe a name off if we use it. And oftentimes on a day-to-day basis, I add to it.
Do you kind of have a rule about you won't recycle a TED talk that was used in one topic to use in another program on a different topic?
You know, it's not a hard and fast rule, but we try not to, because there are so many amazing TED talks that we really want to give an opportunity to as many speakers as we can and to listeners to be exposed to as many different ideas as we can expose them to.
Are there some things that make a good TED Radio Hour that are somewhat different from what make a compelling TED Talk or a TED Talk that's worth listening to?
You know, TED Talks obviously have the huge advantage of being visual, right? So they're videoed and people are watching them. And so there are a lot of things that you can point to without describing them. You know, there might be a TED speaker who will say, so for example, humans are like this. And, you know, behind you, they might show a photograph of an ape, you know, doing something silly, right? The challenge that we have is in finding moments in the talks that work on the radio. The advantage we have is that we bring the speaker into the show, right? So it's like me and the speaker are sitting in a screening room. It's almost like we're sitting in the screening room watching their TED Talk, then hitting pause, and then I'll look at the speaker and go, you know, and say, wait, what are you talking about here? What do you mean at this point? And so that's sort of how we kind of present the idea in a completely different way than it was presented on the TED stage, as a complement to how it was presented on the TED stage. And then we are able to sort of take it into a different direction or go down a different rabbit hole.
Is it important then that interview segment that you have with the TED speaker adds something that didn't come across in the TED Talk in order to take it a little further and make it something different for radio?
Yeah, I mean, it happens pretty much every time, which is we do a lot of research on the people we interview, and we look for stories about them or stories that they may have come across in their research that maybe they didn't get time to talk about in the TED Talk or really kind of elaborate on in the TED Talk. And so what we try to do is to really mine those stories, because of course radio is at its core, it's a narrative format, and narrative storytelling works really effectively in getting ideas across. So our challenge and what we try to do every week is to marry the idea of presenting big ideas through a narrative journey.
From your standpoint as a journalist, what was interesting about the TED Radio Hour after you had covered stories overseas for NPR, been a bureau chief in places like London, hosted weekends, all things considered? What drew you then to the TED Radio Hour and being the host and editorial director?
Well, it was really an opportunity that I don't think anybody would have passed up. I was hosting weekend, all things considered. I loved it. We had an incredible team. We tried amazing experimental stuff on that show. But this opportunity sort of came around, and it was a chance to, I mean, imagine if somebody said, here's this blank room, you know, filled with all this really cool stuff, like, you know, googly eyes and glitter and paint and glue sticks and markers and, you know, just, you know, every pipe cleaner, is just everything that you could possibly imagine. Here are the keys to the room. Just do whatever you want. Just like go do whatever you want inside. We'll come back and check on you in a couple months. I mean, that was basically what we got to do with the TED Radio Hour. So some folks from my team on Weekend All Things Considered came with me to TED Radio Hour. We joined up with a small group of amazing producers who I've worked with for most of my career. So there are people on our show who I mentored as interns. There are people on the show who mentored me as an intern, 17 years ago. And we sort of got the keys to this playroom, and that was an opportunity that I don't think any of us would have passed up.
So what are some things that we might be hearing in the coming weeks on the TED Radio Hour?
Well, we're doing a really cool show in a couple of weeks on a forbidden topic on the radio, a topic that the FCC hasn't banned, but they might as well for radio, because as you know, Gordon, we cannot, the third rail of broadcasting is talking about numbers. Can't talk about numbers on the air. Too confusing, right?
You're going to lose the listener if you start talking numbers.
Right?
Yeah.
So we decided to touch the third rail of broadcasting and do a whole show about numbers. And the fascinating thing about numbers is they actually run our lives. So I'm not a numbers person. I was like, I was struggled through calculus. You know, I don't even know how I took it. It was so difficult. Math was so hard for me when I was in high school. I didn't do any math in college. But numbers are fast. I mean, they really run our lives. From the moment you wake up to the moment you go to sleep, there's an algorithm behind the technology you use, or you know, the way that gas and water are delivered to your home, or the price you pay on Amazon for a product. We don't even realize this. And it's gotten to a point where the numbers, the equations that we plug into computers, they sort of get a life of their own, you know, through the processing power of a computer, that we no longer understand how algorithms solve problems. All we know is that computers can create these very complex algorithms, but we just don't know how they work. And it's pretty incredible. This is a, you know, and it's getting even more and more complex. So the whole show, it's about numbers. There's even a whole section on love that, you know, if you plug in the right equation, you can increase your chances of finding the perfect partner, stuff like that. It's going to be a really, really cool show, and I hope people like it.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing that in the weeks ahead.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really fun.
Guy Raz, thank you very much for your time.
Gordon, thank you.
Guy Raz is the host and editorial director of NPR's TED Radio Hour. He joined us from Washington, D.C., and you can hear the TED Radio Hour Saturday mornings at 11 on WMUK. Links to more information about NPR's TED Radio Hour can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. John Hoadley was elected to the State House in November. The Democrat represents the city of Kalamazoo and also parts of Portage and Kalamazoo Township in Michigan's 60th State House District. John Hoadley, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with the state budget. There's a shortfall right now, and lawmakers are looking for a way to fill it. And yesterday, we're speaking on Friday, yesterday there was a move to take money from the school aid fund to help fill that budget hole. Democrats such as yourself were not very happy with that outcome. What would you do instead?
We have a constitutional duty to balance the budget, so I'm empathetic to that. And frankly, I do appreciate the detail to which the governor and his executive order was trying to mitigate harms. So I think there's reasonable cuts that can be made. But here's the first biggest concern, which is the reason we have to do these cuts at all is because there are these legacy tax credits. They were a bipartisan bad idea, and now they've busted a hole in our budget. And so until we have a reasonable solution in the long term for these legacy tax credits, we're going to continue to make these cuts. So what we're saying is we did not need to rush this. What we needed is for business leaders to come back to the table, share in the sacrifice that so many of us have been sharing in for the last 4 years and beyond, and say, you know, can you give a little bit back? Can you help us get some predictability? Can you help spread out those payments? And so as a result, we would not have been forced to make these cuts. But that said, you know, we have to find new revenue in the budget if we want to fix the roads, improve our schools, and tackle the numerous priorities that voters sent us to Lansing to deal with.
Are there other areas to get new revenue besides negotiating the tax credits with these businesses that have received them?
I think there's a lot of ways that we can look at creating an equitable tax solution in Michigan. Part of that might be through tweaking fees that exist. For example, even the Farm Bureau supports expanding the fees associated with phosphorus in use in agricultural products. So it's not overly burdensome to nitrogen, and we can help expand it on phosphorus. And as a result, pay for the environmental programs that are helping us upgrade and, you know, manage farms in Michigan through the meat program. So there's creative ways to do that. Additionally, we could have a conversation about giving a tax cut or keeping the tax burden the same for 95% of Michiganders while finding a way to generate $600 million in new revenue if we talked about a graduated income tax. So there's lots of things we could do that would have a long-term solution that really helps us equitably share in the sacrifice, but reinvest in our communities that can make Michigan great.
Is the talk of graduated income tax going anywhere in Lansing anytime soon?
That's a conversation that ultimately will be before voters. So even if you don't see a lot of legislative movement on it, and I think you will soon, The reality is that voters need to be having this conversation. And we're having that conversation in lots of different ways. You know, when we're talking about the May ballot proposal that would not only find a long-term solution to funding our roads, but keep schools, local community, and low-income folks whole in the process, you know, we're having that conversation right now if we're asking our sales tax and our use tax to increase to 7%. Is it appropriate to be having a conversation about increasing the corporate income tax to 7% as well? So it's fair across the board. And if we're having larger conversations about how do we fund the priorities of our state, including overall conversation about a graduated income tax, even if we decide not to move in that direction, I think is appropriate. So we're really putting every option out on the table.
Let me go back to tax credits for a moment. You mentioned the idea that the state perhaps could negotiate with these businesses, something that Governor Snyder has also indicated. But, you know, how tough should the state negotiate with businesses over tax credits when, in fact, the state did approve them? This is more or less a contract where the state has promised these tax credits for now a ways into the future. So, you know, how do you deal with these businesses and try to get something that's going to work for the state and for them?
Well, when we're talking about these tax credits and these legacy tax credits that we've inherited, despite the fact that we've had a change in corporate tax income system, right? That let's be clear about the scope of the problem. When we were originally told about these taxes, we thought it might be $3.5 billion in legacy credits. Now, that number continues to trickle up and up. The last number I saw that the projected actual value of those tax credits between now and 2032 would be $10.8 billion. And anyone who's run a business knows that you cannot do adequate planning for the future with, you know, a constant fluctuating number on the expense side. And those just bust holes in our budget. So, you know, this idea that these are contracts and thus that there's nothing we can do about it, I think is a bit disingenuous. The context of the contract has changed. And just like we appointed emergency managers to break contracts that were legal contracts from unions and pensions that were protected under our state constitution, just like that we've changed some of the original intent related to how we fund schools and money that was meant for K-12 classrooms, I think there's some flexibility here to say, let's all come back to the table and negotiate in good faith. The pendulum swung. These tax credits at the time that they were negotiated may have represented something about 25 to 30% of the expected income from the overall tax system at the time. So even when we are making folks before me these mega credits or battery credits decisions, you know, they represented a smaller portion of the overall business tax revenue. But at the time that we've now dramatically changed what the corporate tax system looks like, representing an 86% cut to businesses, and we know as individuals that we've had to pay more and more, the legacy costs of these tax credits are now unreasonable. And so I'm saying that let's work together to find a solution. And I think that's a combination of reducing some and spreading out those payments or capping cash refunds over time. These are all things that we could talk about. But the important thing is if we don't talk about them, then we're going to have budget busting hole after budget busting hole.
You have co-sponsored legislation that would prohibit openly carrying guns in what are supposed to be weapons-free zones. Now, explain, first of all, how someone has been able to openly carry a gun in a weapons-free zone in the first place.
Through interpretations and technical changes, there has been a bit of a loophole that's been created related to the Concealed Weapons Act. Back when we changed the way that folks access concealed pistol licenses in the state of Michigan, which we made it easier for folks and more people to obtain those licenses, there was a reasonable compromise that said there are places where people do not expect guns. And so we want to make sure that people aren't concealing their weapons as they're going into these places. Common sense places like schools, childcare centers, large sporting events. And so folks came to this agreement, 10, 15 years ago. Over the last few years, because of other changes at the federal, state, and technical levels, there's been a loophole that's been created that says if you have a concealed pistol license and you're in a gun-free or weapon-free zone, you still can't conceal your weapon, but you can openly carry it. Now, it's important to remember that this is just a subset of the total population. I don't have a CPL, and if I were to openly carry in one of these places, that would be in violation of the law and the technicalities. However, my partner who does have a CPL, if he were to do openly carry in those places, then he would be legally allowed to. At the end of the day, teachers, students, parents, we don't know who's a licensed carrier or not in these zones. And so all we're saying is, let's be reasonable. Let's close this technicality and say that weapons-free zones really should be weapons-free zones. So only those people who have taken an oath to protect and serve really are carrying those weapons in appropriate situations related to the job. Everyone else, you know, students don't need to be interrupted with that. Teachers shouldn't have to make the decision. Do we think that this is a parent who's just openly caring, or is this someone who's intending to cause harm to students?
But right now, most of the legislation which is passing in Lansing and finding its way to Governor Snyder's desk has been to relax gun laws. So is there going to be support for what you're trying to do by saying that someone cannot bring a gun into a weapons-free zone?
We need to start this conversation and sort of re-engage in this conversation, because the empirical data is suggesting that as we increase access overall, it's not producing the desired outcome of keeping us safer. And all Representative Shore and I are saying is that the teachers, students, people that use these educational facilities have asked us to close this technicality. And, you know, and I think we can have a respectful conversation about the competing liberty interests that we all have, for folks who want to keep and bear arms and folks that want to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness while feeling safe in places they're compelled to be, like schools. And so ours is hoping to advance that conversation. Now, one thing that I think is interesting is even as we've passed a set of bills that potentially are going to make it easier for folks to access guns in the state of Michigan, the number of people that are now voting against these sort of provisions is significantly larger than it was last legislative session.
So you mean more lawmakers are voting against relaxing gun laws and, for instance, outlawing county gun boards?
Correct. So we're seeing that there is a return to the center in the conversation that says, while we want to make sure that we are respecting and upholding everybody's constitutional right, that does mean everybody's. And we need to have a rational adult conversation related to what does it mean to the responsibility to keep and bear arms.
On May 5th, the voters in Michigan are going to decide whether or not they want to raise the sales tax 1%. That is a vote on which the entire package to boost road funding hinges at this point. But the polling does not look very promising for that ballot proposal. So should you and your fellow lawmakers be working right now on some sort of an alternative that you could put into action if voters reject that ballot proposal on May 5th?
So paraphrasing a comment that Senator O'Brien made recently, you know, she said she has concerns about the way the poll was done. And beyond that, you know, she said, how many people voted for the PPT reform that ultimately either didn't know exactly what it did to start with or still had some questions and concerns? And I think this is a very similar situation. There is a group of folks that are out there encouraging a no vote on transportation funding that are opposed to taxes in total. And they don't have an alternative to how we address what voters have identified as a top concern, fix our roads. So, you know, the reality of this is I think folks are being a bit disingenuous. I would hope that people take the time to educate themselves on what really is and what's not in this initiative. When folks asked us to deal with the road funding issue, and again, this was before I came to Lansing, there was two things that they were taking into account. First is that we have to fix these roads. And I have a feeling as the roads freeze and thaw in March and April, we're going to be reminded of our pothole problem that we have here in Michigan. And they said, can we not pay the sales tax on the gasoline? And so the legislature found a way to do both those pieces, but at the same time do in a way that protected our schools, did not jeopardize police and fire at the local level, that helped us make sure that we weren't disproportionately hurting the lowest wage earners in our state who are working hard but would struggle with an increased sales or use tax. And so this is a result of the compromise. At the end of the day, a yes vote in May at the statewide proposal will mean that we have somewhere between $1.2 and $1.3 billion more every year to spend on fixing our roads and our bridges, as well as public transportation. It's going to keep schools whole, and it's going to allow us to support police, fire, and low-income folks.
So you are advocating a yes vote on May 5th.
When folks ask my opinion, I think this is our best opportunity to solve a long-term problem. And, you know, I appreciate that for the last few years, we've been really at a point where we're trying to solve some of the problems that have plagued Michigan for decades. And, you know, it doesn't mean that every solution that we've had is something that I would agree with. And frankly, there are parts of this proposal that I'm not thrilled about. But I think part of compromise and part of engaging in adult conversation to solve adult problems for the state of Michigan means that you have to say, I'm okay with the fact that 80 or 85% of what we're trying to do is going to be accomplished. And while we may come back and try to work to improve pieces around the edges, this is probably our best chance for a long-term solution.
I understand that there may be concerns about how the polling is done, but there's a couple different polls out there that show that the sales tax proposal is either not passing or it may be roughly tied. But I haven't seen a poll yet where it's above 50%. And most people who study polling in much greater detail than I do will tell you that if you're not above 50% for yes, you're in trouble because ultimately it's going to be whittled away as time goes on. So I guess I'm going to go back to my original question, which is, should you be working on Plan B, even if it never has to come to reality because the sales tax passes? Should you be working on that now and perhaps giving the voters a sense of what they will have to deal with if they decide not to approve the sales tax?
I think that Plan B conversation already happened and happened in lame duck at the end of last year. You know, the Bolger plan that the Republican leader pushed said we can pay for the road improvements that people are asking for by dramatically cutting schools. That was Plan B. And the reality of this is I think voters deserve the chance to have a full conversation on what does the ballot proposal really mean. You know, we've seen conversations shift just in the last few weeks as more and more voters are hearing the full story of what the proposal may entail. And, you know, so to say that we should be working on a Plan B really short circuits the democratic process right now. We elected legislators who last session made a decision that not everybody agrees with, but it's the compromise that was placed on the ballot. And now voters have a chance to study, learn, and engage in that debate. So you're right, there were some initial polls that were taken that showed that there wasn't a lot of support. But I have we ultimately may not end up with 50%. But if voters are saying, well, what's the better option? I think they should study the opportunities that were presented at the end of last session and see if they prefer the Bolger plan or some other gas tax increase that the Senate passed. And if that's not to their liking, then I would hate to be discouraging, but I don't think there's a significant Plan B available at this point.
I want to ask you a little bit about how you see your role moving forward here, because Democrats are in the minority, of course, in both the House and the Senate. And you are here in Southwest Michigan, where there is one Democratic representative surrounded by several Republicans in the state House and then Republicans in the state Senate. I'm wondering if that requires a greater degree of compromise on your part, recognizing that the other side has the votes to do what they want most of the time, or if you're the lone Democrat representing a region, does it mean that you stand up a little taller and try to promote more progressive values in a way that brings attention to them? I guess I'm wondering what your approach is going forward.
I'm glad that the Kalamazoo delegation has actually a very good working relationship together. And one thing that we've all agreed on is that it doesn't matter if there's a D or an R after our name. If there's things that are going to help Kalamazoo, Southwest Michigan, we want to work together to make sure that that attention from the state is really shining on our region of Michigan. So that's something that we're going to work together on. You know, I do think there is a role that says we need to hear from all sides in a debate. We need to be putting new ideas out there in the marketplace. Because it doesn't matter if you're in the majority or the minority. A good idea is a good idea. And I think part of my role is to encourage that conversation. I obviously am going to have some different priorities than other representatives or some senators in the region, and that's okay. I hope that they'd be willing to listen to my ideas, and when it's something they agree with, you know, don't worry about whose party it is and work together, just like I plan to partner with them on things that, you know, I think are a good idea, even if they don't necessarily go with party orthodoxy.
State Representative John Hoadley, thank you for your time.
I appreciate being here.
John Hoadley is a Democrat. He represents the city of Kalamazoo and parts of Portage and Kalamazoo Township in Michigan's 60th State House District. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.